Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, live in New York, and this is Reliable Sources, where we examine the story behind the story, and we figure out what's reliable. This hour, American conservatives gathering in Hungary to hear from the Prime Minister there, Viktor Orban. And you need to know what they heard. We're going to get into that. Plus, one of this month's controversial GOP primary candidates, she is blaming Sean Hannity for her loss. Kathy Barnett will join me live. And there are shakeups at SNL. We're going to talk with late night expert Bill Carter about the big star exits and this week's upfronts and so much more. But first, an epic struggle over the future of talking and tweeting. Right now, all stories lead back to Elon Musk. He is everywhere. One minute, he's like a head of state holding a key meeting with Brazil's president. The next minute, he's like a teenage troll tweeting crude emojis and memes. Musk continues to say that his original agreement to buy Twitter is on hold. But the company is saying the opposite, arguing there's no such thing as on hold. Twitter's board is saying it will enforce the merger agreement, despite Musk's apparent belated concerns about bots on the platform. So has Musk outsmarted everyone with this bots excuse, or is he like a student who failed to do his homework and now he's lashing out, saying it's everyone else's fault? In this case, the ramifications for Twitter and beyond are global in nature. Let's make sense of it with Margaret Sullivan, the Washington Post's media columnist and author of the forthcoming book Newsroom Confidential. Also from the Post, national correspondent Philip Bump and disinfo debunker Kaya Himmelman. She's a fact-check reporter with the Dispatch. Welcome, everybody. Philip, is anybody believing Elon Musk's narrative here that he's concerned about spam bots on Twitter and that's why he's going to hit pause on this deal? Does anybody buy it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his base of supporters, especially on social media, think that he's telling the truth, right? I mean, this is what he's been very good at. He has this very strong supportive community that backs him. They are very vocal on social media. Do experts believe it? No, not particularly. Matt Levine from Bloomberg wrote a really excellent and scathing column sort of saying, well, his original complaint about Twitter was the bots. That's theoretically why he wanted to buy it. So now to say that there's too many bots is why he doesn't want to buy it is a little disingenuous.
Yes,
obviously, there's stock price, machinations and so on and so forth. But yeah, I mean, he's fighting this interesting social media war with this huge base of support. You know, how does that play out in a courtroom? That's a whole different issue.
Right. And this is definitely going to be a legal battle. Right. Can he wiggle his way out of the deal? Margaret, why does this matter beyond just Twitter hardcore users? Why do you think this matters to everybody, even folks who don't use Twitter?
Well, Brian, the social media platforms, and I think maybe even particularly Twitter, are very influential in our overall kind of media ecosystem, how everybody gets informed. You don't have to be on Twitter to be affected by it. And, you know, Musk's ownership of Twitter, if it comes to that, which is dubious, would be extremely influential. And his talk about being a free speech absolutist, while it sounds kind of good in a way, I don't think would actually work out very well for the users of Twitter because it would introduce even more horrible stuff than is there now and make it much more unusable, especially for women and marginalized groups who suffer there anyway.
Even more harassment, even more chaos, even more poison. This week, Twitter announced a new crisis misinformation policy, an interesting phrase. They're basically trying to take further action, Kaya, in breaking news moments, in moments of crisis, to diminish liars on the platform. But I have to wonder, you know, they're announcing this while Musk is trying to buy the platform, or maybe still trying to buy the platform, and saying he wants to restore a lot of freedom and freedom of speech. This was like sticking it to Musk. But what do you make of this policy as well?
This policy has been in the works since last year.
Pre-Musk.
Okay. Yeah, reportedly. So it seems like we also know the consequences of misinformation on the internet since January 6th, since Ukraine. So it seems like this is bigger than Musk. Mm. And to say that this is despite Musk seems like a little short-sighted, I would say.
But it shows that these tech companies are trying, they're continuing to try to deal with the nonsense that pollutes the internet. You live in this world on this beat every day. How do you size up the disinformation landscape?
Yeah, unfortunately, it is a huge issue. And I think some content moderation, I mean, it is helpful. We're still working on it. You know, it's bigger than we know. And I think this is a good first step. We'll see what happens if Elon Musk ends up buying Twitter if he keeps the policy in place or not. But it's certainly a good first step. It's a huge issue, and, you know, steps need to be taken.
Everybody stay with me, much more in a moment. But Musk is in the news for other reasons as well. On Thursday, the website Insider published an allegation that he sexually harassed a SpaceX flight attendant in 2016. The unnamed accuser says Musk propositioned her for sex, and SpaceX paid a $250,000 settlement for her silence. That's according to Insider. Musk tweeted that the incident never happened. He then bashed the website and said Tesla is building a hardcore litigation department, adding, there will be blood. Here to respond is the global editor-in-chief for Insider, Nicholas Carlson. He's in Davos for the World Economic Forum's annual meeting there. Nick, tell us about your decision to publish. Why did this unnamed accusation meet your standards for publishing?
Well, anytime you have a very powerful man and there are credible accusations that he's done something wrong the way that he was accused of doing in this story. And then when further, there's a settlement that the company paid. I'll note that neither the company nor Musk has denied the settlement. They've denied the underlying allegations. And so that's absolutely and sort of obviously newsworthy.
So because there's a document showing a settlement, that makes it newsworthy in your mind. Tell us about the timeline. When did your team first ask Musk's camp for comment? Because he was tweeting earlier this week saying political attacks on me will escalate dramatically in the coming months. And then he announced he's going to vote Republican. Did your all's request for comment come before or after these tweets?
It came before all those tweets. And I would only be able to speculate, you know, what he was attempting to do. But we asked him for comment. He then reached out and said, I'd like more time. He actually waited about 9 or 10 hours before asking for more time. We said, okay, you can have more time. And I reached out to him personally a few times, said, come talk to us. We want to hear from you. And, you know, as is often the case in these sorts of circumstances, he declined to use the more time that we granted him. But yes, all of the requests were in before he was asked going on the sort of rant about whatever political party he's joining at the moment.
Yeah, so a lot of folks think he retweeted those comments because of the request for comment about the allegation, but we don't know for sure. So it's been several days now. Has Musk threatened legal action against your website?
We haven't faced any legal threats from Musk yet. We are prepared to defend the story vigorously. The line is, and it's the truth, is that we stand by our story, which is based on documents and interviews and speaks for itself. It really does.
And what about the accuser in this case, the unnamed accuser? Have your reporters been in touch with her, and does she have any further comments?
You know, what we're going to do is we're going to stay in touch with our sources. We're going to look for more documents. We are going to pursue any leads that avail themselves to us. And when there's more to say, we'll say it. And it'll be as thoroughly vetted and as solid and rock solid as the last report we made on this.
I do wonder what it was like for you. You run a big newsroom, and you're backed by a big company. But here you are reporting news about the richest man in the world. Is there ever a moment where you hesitate, where you fear publishing?
Well, you know, this is an important story. And if you're going to be in the journalism business, when you have a story that is a credible, documented accusation in which the company pays a settlement a couple years after the incident, and it's corroborated in the sense that a friend put a document together to say that contemporaneously that she heard this. It's just obviously newsworthy. It's a little trepidatious given his enormous influence and wealth, as you mentioned. You know, he could put all the lawyers on retainer for the rest of his life and not even notice. And so, you know, we had to be sure. We had to be rock solid on this, and we have great support in our corporate ownership and grateful for it. And it's really what we're here to do, is bring this kind of truth to the world.
Nick Carlson, thank you very much for coming on the program. Back with the panel now. Philip Bump, this decision by Musk to say, hey, by the way, I'm a Republican now, right, just a few hours after being asked for comment. Who knows if it's connected? But Musk does represent something bigger in our politics right now. He says he was a Democrat, he says he supported Democrats, and now he can't stand the left, and he's heading to the right. And there's a lot of people like him, and he's actually a symbol of something bigger happening in the culture right now.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, this is a huge issue even outside of Elon Musk, as you point out. I mean, this idea that he is trying to, first of all, there's the idea that he's trying to leverage partisanship to defend himself against this accusation, as appears to have been the case.
Yeah.
It's very hard to believe that it's a coincidence, as you point out, that all of a sudden he started making these noises about partisanship immediately before this report came out. That by itself, of course, is a very big problem that we have these days, where everyone is being encouraged to see news reporting through a partisan lens.
Right.
Then, of course, you have this broader question, you know, with this meme that he tweeted out about how he stayed in the middle and the left has moved to the left, that has spurred all this analysis, including from myself. You know, this is part of the conversation that he is spurring about Twitter, right? He's having this conversation about Twitter that is itself predicated on partisanship. Mm. And so he's looping this same insider fight into this idea that he needs to rise to Twitter's defense because the right is being excluded from the conversation, which, of course, has been something percolating, you know, since well before Donald Trump left office. But that's a fundamental question, right? This is the issue of this partisan tension in the United States that manifests in all these unexpected ways.
Right. Musk bashing Democrats. He's not the only one going after Biden recently. Earlier in the week, Jeff Bezos, who, of course, used to be the CEO of Amazon, one of the other richest people in the world, and the owner of The Washington Post, he called out the Biden administration. He's been posting tweets about inflation, about other policy proposals. There's something that feels a little Elon Musk-y in Bezos's tweets. I wonder, Margaret Sullivan, since you are at The Washington Post like Philip, does this make your job more difficult when your billionaire owner is tweeting not just about, you know, how great Amazon is, but about policy proposals?
I mean, I can honestly say that it does not make my job more difficult. And, you know, I have had the interesting experience of working at two newspapers that have been owned by billionaires, Warren Buffett at the Buffalo News and Jeff Bezos at the Washington Post. And, you know, doesn't mean I agree with everything they are or have done or will be or say on various platforms and places. But what I will say is that they have both done what I consider the two most important things, which is to provide financial stability. Buffett no longer owns the Buffalo News, but when he did, that was the case. Yeah. And that they've kept their hands off the paper's journalism and its editorial policies. So no, it hasn't made my job more difficult.
No, there's different kinds of billionaire ownership. And in this case,
yes, he hands off.
That's what you want.
That's right.
Kaya, another big headline, a story broken by the Washington Post this week, was about the Disinformation Governance Board, this Department of Homeland Security board that was going to try to bring together different parts of the government and what they're doing to try to stop people from getting tricked by lies on the internet.
Sure.
Sounded logical, but this thing was doomed to fail. It became a conservative meme. They called it the Ministry of Truth, relentlessly mocked it, and especially mocked the leader of the board, Nina Jankowicz, who had a history online of posting lots of liberal opinions and some misinformation. So just break it down for us. Like, what the heck happened here with this Disinformation Governance Board?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first issue is the name. I think the word disinformation is highly politicized. I think we learned that during the 2020 election. I think disinformation, fact-checking what I do, is a super politicized term. I think we're seeing that play out. I think that's the number one issue. I think we saw the takedown of that board through a disinformation campaign. I think the number one thing we learned is how powerful these disinformation campaigns are. I think we've also learned that we are still very reactive to disinformation. We haven't yet learned how to be proactive. Unfortunately, I don't think we've reached that point. I think we are very far from that point. I think we're still struggling from January 6th, which came as a tremendous surprise to us. I think we're still reeling from that. You know, this was a bad outcome, but hopefully a learning experience for all of us. And I think the biggest takeaway here is there's a lot of work to be done, and disinformation is rampant, and we do not really know how to handle it quite yet.
I think you can learn a lot by who's defensive and who's offensive these days.
Totally.
And the Biden administration announcing this board, completely defensive and doomed. All right, to the panel, thank you, everybody. Stick around. More in just a moment. Up next, what the crime scene in Buffalo has in common with an authoritarian leader's remarks in Central Europe. Margaret's going to rejoin us from Buffalo with her observations. But first, you saw those pictures in the corner of the screen a few moments ago. The first military flight carrying an emergency supply of baby formula has just landed near Indianapolis, Indiana. Baby formula flown in on a military plane. This is part of the Biden administration's Operation Fly formula as Americans are coping with a nationwide shortage. The pallets of baby formula were flown here from Germany. This staff, the master sergeant overseeing the shipment, telling his staff, quote, "We are literally saving babies." But this is both a failure as well as a success. The existence of this plane is a failure of the government and a failure of corporations as well, even though these pictures today are meant to symbolize a success by the Biden administration. More to come on this, but now a quick break here on Reliable Sources and more in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
The Conservative Political Action Committee just held in the U.S. just held its first conference in Europe. It chose Hungary because, according to its website, the country is one of the bastions of the conservative resistance to the ultra-progressive woke revolution. The keynote speaker at CPAC Hungary was Hungary's far-right leader, Viktor Orban. He had some advice for Republicans in the U.S. A, if you don't like what the media is saying, you should have your own media. Orban, of course, accused of taking over and influencing and controlling the media in Hungary. He also said, make sure Tucker Carlson-type shows are on the air night and day, 24-7, he said. Many non-Hungarian reporters wanted to cover this conference, but outlets like Vice, Rolling Stone, Vox, the AP were apparently all turned away. Some outlets like CBS were able to attend. We've been able to hear about the conference, but there was an interesting blockade of the media at CPAC Hungary. Let's bring back our panel, Margaret Sullivan, Philip Bump, Kaya Himmelman. Philip Bump, what is the importance of Orban giving this advice to U.S. conservatives at the same conference where Tucker Carlson appeared, other far-right figures as well?
I think it's really important to start from the fact that CPAC chose to go to Hungary as a model of governance, right? Mm-hmm. This is the American right has long been obsessive about patriotism and, you know, America's supremacy and, you know, the exceptionalism of the United States. Now they go to Hungary, where they are, you know, basically paying homage to an authoritarian leader who is taking all of these very hardline stands against what the American right sees as progressive values. I mean, I think that is by itself extremely symbolic. And then, of course, we have Orban who comes forward and says, this is the sort of media you ought to have. If an autocrat is telling you what your media should look like, that's not what you do.
That's not what you do.
Like, I mean, what else can you say about it? It's alarming. I mean, there's no other way to say it. And, you know, the fact that the American right sees Orban and sees the policies of Orban as something to emulate is disconcerting.
I do see a bit of a connection between Hungary and Budapest and Buffalo, and here's what it is. There was quite a bit of replacement-type talk at the CPAC Hungary conference, not always with the words replacement theory, but in the idea about immigrants replacing white people. And, of course, as we know, Margaret Sullivan, the suspect in Buffalo subscribed to this racist white replacement theory. He wrote all about it in his racist screed before entering that supermarket last weekend. You've been there in Buffalo, where you worked for many years. You've been there all week long. What are your observations from that community, given that this racist talk is what drove the suspect into that mostly black supermarket?
Right. Well, there's no question, in my mind at least, Brian, and we always have to use words like alleged, but I think that we do know that the gunman was motivated by the same kind of broad and growing ideology that we're seeing in these other places that you're talking about. This idea that white people are being replaced by Jews, by black people, by the other. And it is a very ugly and clearly a very destructive and a very disturbing tendency. And you cannot really separate the strands of Tucker Carlson on Fox News and 4chan and all the other ways that this this ideology is making its way into our society in very, very disturbing and very, very destructive ways. And it's just been a devastating event here in Buffalo, and you know, one that is, you know, you can't even really get your mind around. It's so bad, and we know why it happened.
One of your columns was titled, "It's Time for Local Journalists to Reckon with the Racism We Overlooked." As a former editor of the Buffalo News there, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that this is not just true of local journalism, but journalists everywhere. But certainly there have been policies, and this is true in Buffalo, that have created or enabled or aided the segregation of a community and the racism in a community that brought this shooter here. I mean, he didn't go just anywhere. He was from Binghamton, and he looked around to see where is the place that, where is the zip code that he could drive to easily that had the highest concentration of black people. And he came up with this neighborhood on the east side of Buffalo. So, you know, what are the things that have created and sustained that atmosphere? And, you know, it is not just about Buffalo, but it includes Buffalo. And it's something that, you know, in terms of coverage, policy, overall approach, we need to do much, much, much better on.
Now there's talk about regulation of social media. Those are big cans of worms that could go in very bad directions. But Kaya, we saw Senator Chuck Schumer writing a letter to Fox bosses, to the Murdochs, imploring them to halt racist rhetoric. I worry that there's not enough examination of the internet here as a role. As Margaret mentioned, the 4chans of the world. And it's not just, I don't know, is disinformation even the proper word for the kind of racist rabbit holes that people can fall down? I guess disinformation is part of it.
Yeah, I mean, disinformation is such a broad term. I mean, it includes so much. I mean, yeah. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about. There's this parody website that I've been fact-checking a lot called Real Raw News, which is, I mean, it's literally parody news, but it's conspiratorial. It's super dangerous. They have headlines like about fake executions and about the COVID vaccines containing all sorts of dangerous ingredients. And I mean, it's dangerous. It's pernicious. And I mean, I don't even know if you can characterize that as disinformation. It seems like something more,
like almost worse somehow.
Totally.
I'm looking at it right now. I'm thinking this is all these lies. It's just a website full of lies, but it could pass as the Buffalo News. What do we do about that? But here's the concern, right? Do we really want the House and the Senate to come up with a law to figure out what to do with websites full of lies?
Right. I mean, I guess that's kind of the question. I mean, I guess you continue to fact check the work that I do. I will continue to do, you know, fact check, even though, you know, people say, like, why do you fact check such ridiculous claims? People believe it.
Right.
You know, people really believe it. It's not just ridiculous stuff on the internet.
And then they think they're onto hidden knowledge that no one else tells them. And then they can form like-minded communities. And that is the worry. Right. And to your point, this is so broad. Hate to sound hopeless.
Well, I mean, that was when you spoke with QAnon people. That was what they said. I did my own research. This is what I found. Mm-hmm. The research that they were doing was that garbage, right? Mm-hmm. And this is where you land.
That's what the Buffalo suspect sounds like to me, unfortunately. All right, to the panel, thank you very much. A great conversation here. For more of our daily dispatches about all this news, sign up for our nightly Reliable Sources newsletter at reliablesources.com. Did Sean Hannity make the difference for Dr. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania? Look at all those interviews. One of Oz's rivals is accusing Hannity of lying about her, and you're going to hear from her next. When Dr. Mehmet Oz stepped on stage Tuesday night to celebrate his potential win in the GOP Senate primary in Pennsylvania, he quickly thanked Donald Trump and then Sean Hannity. Yes, Oz benefited from the so-called Fox primary, with Hannity featuring Oz in primetime 21 times. Oz said Hannity also helped him behind the scenes.
Sean's like a brother to me. He understands exactly how to make a difference, and he's been doing that this entire campaign, much of it behind the scenes.
Oz and David McCormick are now heading toward a recount in a too-close-to-call race. The third place finisher was Kathy Barnett, and she is blaming Hannity, among others, for her loss. Kathy Barnett joins us now for her first interview here on CNN. Kathy, thank you for coming on. Just a housekeeping question first. Are you officially conceding the race in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, you know, I am. I believe Pennsylvanians have made their voice clear. I, like so many others here in Pennsylvania, we're watching to see what happens over the next couple of days. And I will certainly stand by what the voters of Pennsylvania have decided to do.
That means you will endorse the nominee in your state?
I will, you know, whoever should prevail, I will certainly be in support of them. I want to see the Republican Party win.
Now that this is basically a deadlock between Oz and McCormick, do you think that it was Sean Hannity who put Oz potentially over the top? Was Hannity's influence that important in this race?
Well, I think what we saw with my race is, you know, a broader issue, right? So the spotlight was shining on me, but I think it's a much broader story here, and that is the partisan journalism that we see across both sides of the aisle, because there are so many people. There were people coming at me from the left and from the right. And, you know, on Friday evening, 5 days ago, the American people were being told that I'm a member of Black Lives Matter. And then 3 days later, the same American people were being told that I'm marching with white supremacists, right? And so what that did is created an echo chamber, and it made it very difficult for the voters here in Pennsylvania to know what it is to do. I was just listening to your previous blog. And, you know, there's a reason why so many people feel as though they cannot trust mainstream media and have to go out and do their own research, because there's so much partisan journalism that's going on that is creating a very challenging environment for Americans to know what's true, what's not true.
I was in Warminster last weekend when you shut the media out of a campaign rally with the gubernatorial candidate there. Do you regret shutting out the media from events?
Yeah, no, that's not true, Brian. I did not shut the media out of any event that I was in charge of. I was a guest to someone else's rally. And so as their guest, they got to make the rules. But the next day, I held a press conference. There were well over 30 different media outlets. I have leaned forward the entire time to share my story. I've lived an extraordinary American first life.
No, that's a fair point, that it was Mastriano at that event in Bucks County. Why not answer the basic questions that people asked you during the campaign, though? Last weekend on Fox News Sunday, you were asked, where were you an adjunct professor? And you did not answer that basic question.
Nope, that's not true, Brian. Again, so
it
again,
is. I have the
you know,
transcript
I don't know
here.
If it's late.
You still haven't told us where you taught.
I don't know if it's laziness or being insidious. Nope. I don't know if it's laziness as journalists or just as something more insidious, but it is a dereliction of duty because it is all right there. I have been running for over 13 months, and just 5 days ago, the media finally paid attention that there was someone else other than Mehmet Oz and Dave McCormick running. I worked at Judson University, and what I said, if you can go to my website even now, barnettforsenate.com, and it's there. But if there was true vetting, then you would be vetting on why John Fetterman chased down a black man with a shotgun. And now that particular person is the Democrat nominee for the Senate And so that would be very good vetting that needs to be done. I embellish nothing. My life has been out there as an open book for many years. But again, whether laziness or just something more insidious, the media refused to do their job in presenting just the facts to the American people and allow the American people to make the decision. Instead, what we saw with my race is that people from both sides of the aisle come up with the narrative and then go look for facts to try to back up their agenda. And that has created an environment that's very dangerous for our form of government.
My sense was that when Selena Zito and Shannon Bream asked you about the university, you didn't give the name. But you are right. It is now listed on your website, Judson University. But there were these specific bio questions that you didn't answer when reporters asked them. And I think that was one of the critiques of you, that you were not willing to be vetted. You're saying a lot of other folks are not vetted either.
No, and what I'm saying is, yes, a lot of people were not vetted, but what I'm also saying is that I have been running for 13 months, and I was in a statistical tie for first place for over 4 weeks. Huh. Now, the media only paid attention in the last 5 days of the race, but I was in
a
statistical tie.
So you feel like you were ignored.
That's
interesting.
First place.
Well, but you're right that there was a lot of scrutiny toward the end. There was a lot of scrutiny toward the end.
Right.
CNN's K-File found a long history of bigoted statements in your past, many of them on your Twitter feed. Do you have any response to the folks that say you hate gays and Muslims?
Yeah, you know what? Again, you know, I ran this race. I did a brilliant job in running this race. And again, I don't know if it's laziness as journalists or just something more insidious, but none of those statements were full statements or full thoughts. And again, we have a man who is running for U.S. Senate who chased down a black man who was simply outside jogging, minding his own business, held him up until police came. And there is
I understand that, and Fetterman needs to answer that. Fetterman needs to answer that. He's going to have to answer that. But your history of anti-gay comments would certainly have been used against you in the general as well.
There is no history of anti-gay.
Quote, two men sleeping together, two men holding hands, that's not normal, you said in 2015.
Or being Islamophobic. No, like I said, none of those tweets were full thoughts or full sentences. It was whatever you can copy and paste in a Twitter. You don't know the context. It's 10 years ago. I, like most people in America, you grow or else you just stay static. And so I don't know what the context is, but I've been very clear on what the context of some of those Islamic tweets were at that particular time where we were living. But I don't believe the media cared. And as a result, we've created an echo chamber where the American people are highly uninformed or unsure of what is true and what is not true. And I think that that is going to make a very dangerous, because we're dealing with very real issues. I was watching the previous segments, again, talking about inflation. Last year, I talked to a farmer. He was paying $40,000 just to fertilize 600 acres of corn. This year, it's $120,000. And who do you think are going to eat that? It's going to be the American people. So what we're experiencing now without families with no formula for their babies, or this inflation that is going to continue to ramp up, this administration having no answers for the gas prices or anything, those are the very real issues that people are contending with. That is the reason why I was surging. That is the reason why people were coming over to my campaign, because I kept the main thing, and that's Pennsylvanians. Whereas the media primarily want to go back 10 years.
You couldn't persuade Sean Hannity. Was that the crux of the problem?
Whether or not I can persuade him, over 320,000 Pennsylvanians voted for me. I have lived an exemplary life. If the media was truly interested in understanding what in the world was going on, then they would be looking at how in the world did this young black girl who grew up on a pig farm below the bottom rung of the economic ladder live an exemplary life, embellished absolutely nothing on my resume, was able to compete against two very wealthy people who spent well over $60 million. I spent less than $2 million, and I was on the verge of winning. I think that's the story, is what is it about the American people that caused them to pivot very hard and start coming over to my side? If there was honest journalism, people would be asking that question, because I think I tapped into something and I ran a far more brilliant campaign than my two opponents.
I think we are interested, for the record. That's why I'm glad you came on the program today. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Brian. Trevor
Reed's message about the media now that he's been freed from a Russian prison. That's coming up. Plus, we are going to find something positive to say about all the bad news lately. I promise.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Every time you turn on the news these days, you are swamped by a tsunami of negative news. The only thing that's not happening are tsunamis. I mean, COVID surging in some areas, markets plunging, crypto crashing, inflation raging, gas prices soaring, and there's the baby food shortage and a seemingly never-ending string of mass shootings, the ongoing war in Ukraine, and a monkeypox outbreak? It goes on and on. So is the media supposed to look for silver linings here? Are we just going to give viewers what they want? Let's talk about it with Bill Carter, CNN media analyst and New York Times veteran. Bill, this felt like a uniquely grim week for some reason.
It's really bad, and you left a whole lot out.
I did?
You left out, you know, corruption at the Supreme Court. You left out the threat against democracy. You left out the fact that there was a coup that still has actually
we're still learning examined. More about
more
the
and more
coup
about
attempt.
That. So yeah, it's like I've been around a long time. I don't remember a gigantic pileup as bad as this, nor really a dangerous period, a more dangerous period. I think it's really dangerous for the country.
And political talkers always try to focus on, well, what does it mean for the Democrats and Biden in the midterms? Forget about that for a minute. What does it mean for our psychology,
absolutely,
for our health as a nation and a world when you're just inundated by seemingly negative headlines all the time?
It feels like long COVID. We're in the middle of, we can't get out of long COVID. It's like everything is bad and we can't get healthy again. And really, it's a tremendous challenge, I think, particularly for the media, because what stories do you focus on? How do you not give short shrift to things that are really big in the background when other things happen, like baby formula,
right,
which is a story. If you're a mother that needs formula, that's the story you care about. You have to hear about that.
And the media swarms stories. We go from
absolutely
one big story at a time. So we go to the baby formula stories now, and then we'll be on to something else next week.
Right.
So what do you think gets underappreciated or undercovered right now when we're going from one to another?
Well, I do think the overarching idea that we have a party that really wants to go autocratic is really a threat. It's really dangerous. But the war in Ukraine, that is enormous because that has geopolitical implications that we can't foresee. Mm-hmm. It could be really long-term. We don't know what's going to happen when that gets resolved, if that gets resolved. You can't ignore that. But then you have these race-based incidents now that are really scary, that are, you know, and now we're seeing it spilling over into homophobia. I don't know if you saw the thing online with this guy saying he's going after LGBT people and he's going to get them. He's going after them hard. I think that's another thing that's going to raise its ugly head as this goes on. It's really a very tough time out there.
But to make the counterargument, is it possible that because we see all this bad news in our social feeds as well as on television, it makes the world out to be even uglier than it actually is?
It makes you, it only affects your psyche. I think that's true, but I think the world's bad right now. I think it's legit. It's legit for everyone to say, wow, I don't remember this much. Because I was around for Vietnam. I was around for civil rights movement. There was a lot of bad stuff going on. But the confluence right now feels really quite overwhelming.
But I think your point is, I like the phrase long COVID, applying that to more than just the actual pandemic.
Totally.
It feels like a drag, some sort
absolutely.
Of...
Absolutely. Psychologically long COVID. And people say when you have it, you have brain fog. Well, that's what we sort of have now, where we're like, we can't even think clearly. What are we supposed to really do? How can we attack this?
So,
and I think the media really is important here.
What's the positive part here? Is it that we shouldn't watch so much, read so much, consume so much of this? Or
the positive for me is that we still have free media in this country. Right. We still have a way to attack these things and to try to direct people. Even though there's a lot of people who don't want to listen to media anymore, you can't give up on that. You have to tell the truth. You can't say, oh, there's two sides to homophobia. No, there isn't two sides to homophobia. There isn't two sides to a lot of these issues. You have to be honest about it. But we still have that freedom to do that, and that's really important. They don't have that in Hungary. Mm. People want to celebrate Hungary. They don't have it. We do have it.
All right, much more with Bill in just a moment. We're going to reveal Time Magazine's picks for the most influential members of the media this year.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night.
So are you officially leaving?
Yeah, man. Lauren accidentally gifted me a sock, so I'm free.
SNL wrapped up its 47th season last night and said farewell to a number of cast members, including Kate McKinnon and Pete Davidson. Late night TV expert Bill Carter, author of The Late Shift and The War for Late Night, is here. Bill, is it just me or are these goodbyes, these farewells, a bigger deal than they used to be? Maybe more emotional?
They are. They're for sure more emotional. I think it's partly that Lauren has affection for this cast now. I mean, when Kristen Wiig left, it was a hugely emotional thing. And Kate McKinnon obviously choked up and they gave her that, you know, the opening to give her that incredible platform. And she was a major talent. She's at the top, I think, in the top stratosphere. Davidson, I think, is a remarkable story. The guy, no one knew if he'd survive. He was in big trouble emotionally and with drugs and everything. And he straightened out. He became quite good on the show. He did a fantastic Andrew Cuomo. I don't know if you remember that. He was very good at that. And I think he's going to have a very big career. I do.
Right. And he's going to be in one of these. He was at the Upfronts this week. The TV Upfronts promoting one of his new projects.
He has a show about his life. Yes.
about his life. Yeah. So about the Upfronts, this is traditionally the biggest week of the year in television. All the major networks and YouTube now hold big events in New York City promoting their upcoming programs. And Bill, they've really become corporate presentations about streaming platforms as well as broadcast networks. What did you learn this week?
Well, you really saw that the broadcast networks are a minimal part of it. It used to be they were the focus.
And the whole point of the show.
The whole point of it. And it's really a pitch to advertisers. That's what the Upfronts are. Hey, buy our product, buy our new shows. And, you know, those new shows, they're basically not going to be culturally impactful the way a big hit on Netflix gets to be. It's just people don't live their lives around broadcast shows anymore. But the advertisers need them. They need to have a mass audience somehow because we are so diffused in the country now. We don't really gather in places that are, except for football maybe, and then the prices on football advertising are enormous for that reason. But we're going to see commercials in streaming. That's one of the big developments. I think we're going to see a lot of commercials. There's already some. HBO Max will give you an option. Things. Netflix is going to give you an option. You don't want to pay $15 a month? Well, for $10, you can get it with commercials. And I think that opens the door, and we'll see a lot more of that.
So is this everything old is new again?
It is.
That there's nothing new under the sun?
No.
That, you know, television started with an ad-supporting model, and now streaming's going that way?
Yes, and every medium that television is, or any video, or entertainment, it changes over time. Radio didn't think it would ever go away. TV didn't think it would ever. Cable would take over. Cable didn't think streaming would take over. Now streaming is saying maybe there's too much streaming. It just is a continuum, and you better be on your feet and notice this change happening and react to it.
The other headline for me from the Upfronts was the sheer number of reboots.
Unbelievable.
Old shows coming back. Absolutely. I know this is what happens every year, but I wonder
More than ever.
Okay, is it? Yeah.
More than ever, because you can't. How do you break through with a new show? How do you manage that? Because they used to promote the heck out of it. Nobody's watching to be promoted to. You can't do that, so you have to say, oh, it's a reboot of something you already know, folks. We don't have to tell you what it is. You know what it is.
Right. So you want to. When you say nobody's watching, you mean all in one place at the same time.
Because people
there
watch.
Is more consumption than ever.
Exactly.
It's more complicated.
But nobody watches together the way they used to. Nobody exchange. We aren't sitting there all at the same time watching the Breaking Bad finale, for example. And it makes a big difference because you don't exchange information at the water cooler anymore. You can't. Oh, you didn't see it yet. I can't talk yet. You know, that really changes the way shows are received.
Right. Well, here's a scoop to share with the viewers. Time magazine coming out with its Time 100 list tomorrow. That's the 100 most influential people of the year. But we have a sneak peek at the media names on the list a day early. So here are the Time 100 media influencers. And I got your reaction, Bill. Joe Rogan, David Zaslav, Dmitry Muratov, the Russian journalist, Sevgel Mirzeva, Emily Oster, and Sally Rooney. Let's talk about a couple of these, Bill. David Zaslav, of course, the CEO of CNN's parent company, Warner Brothers Discovery, at his corporate presentation this week, he really described a balance between streaming, linear TV like CNN, theatrical releases.
Right.
And I wonder, maybe that's the new normal for these media companies trying to say, hey, we have our hand in every pot.
Absolutely. And you know, Zaslav is absolutely a worthy inclusion because he's now in the middle of what is going to be a massive transformation at Warner. And I think he's a fascinating character because he's basically a guy who's just built this quiet thing in Discovery. I don't think people were thinking that's the next thing that's going to take over the world. But David is an ambitious and smart guy, and he's maneuvered his way into a great position. And I'm fascinated to see what he's going
to
do.
To see what he does. Joe Rogan on the list as well. Kara Swisher has the blurb in Time magazine about Rogan. I know some people love him, some people hate him.
Yep.
There's no doubting his influence.
Yeah, absolutely influential. And Time has always said, we'll put someone on the, they put the Ayatollah on the cover.
Oh, for Time Person of the Year.
And I'm not saying Joe Rogan's the Ayatollah.
No.
Okay. But I'm just saying, if you are a person who has that kind of cultural impact, you will be included, whether or not it's positive or negative.
Yeah, I like seeing a couple of journalists in Russia and Ukraine, and also author Sally Rooney. Bill, thank you very much for being here. Great to see you.
Always great to see you.
Before we go, Jake Tapper's exclusive interview with Trevor Reed is airing tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The Marine veteran told Tapper that he thanks the media for helping him get out of that atrocious Russian prison. He says if it wasn't for the constant coverage of his plight, he might still be behind bars.
I mean, it's just there's countless people that I need to thank. I'm not going to be able to cover all of them, but another big one that I need to thank is U.S. news media for covering this, because if they had not done that, you know, if they would have said, you know, that's not interesting, that's not really going to be profitable for us, this would have never happened. And U.S. news media played a critical role in accomplishing all of that. So, you know, CNN, ABC, Fox News, everyone who covered that, I want to thank them for doing that. And I want to say keep up the good work and continue to do that with other hostages. We need that. That's something, unfortunately, that our government needs to function. And please keep up the good work. Keep doing that. That's critical.
And you can watch all of Tapper's exclusive interview with Trevor Reed in a CNN special report, Finally Home, the Trevor Reed interview on CNN tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Quick plug for our weekly Reliable Sources podcast as well. This week, it's all about Twitter bots and Elon Musk's claims. We spoke with Professor Kathleen Carley of Carnegie Mellon about what's really going on with spam bots on Twitter. I learned a lot. I'd recommend it to follow it wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we'll see you back here this time next week.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.